detective, madame. I am an international detective.
You mean that you belong to the League of Nations?
I belong to the world, madame. Thank you for your cooperation.
I hope that I have been of some assistance, monsieur.
I assure you of great assistance. Well, monsieur Bouc, was I sufficiently discreet?
The very soul, merci. A very pretty woman. But it didn't advance us much.
No. Two people who saw nothing and heard nothing. I think that we should interview the handsome Colonel Arbuthnot next.
Well, I fear that you will not find him very cooperative.
I don't see that it's any of your business why I decided to return from India by the overland route.
And nevertheless, Colonel...
If you really must know, I wanted to take a look at Earl of the Caldys.
Of course.
And there happened to be an old friend of mine in Baghdad whom I haven't seen in 5 years. Is that good enough for you?
I understand that the young English lady, Miss Debenham, was also returning from Baghdad. Did you meet her there, perhaps?
No, I certainly did not. I first met Miss Debenham in the restaurant car of the Taurus Express, travelling from Kirkuk to Nisibin.
Colonel, I am about to appeal to you. You and Miss Debenham are both English. It is necessary that I should ask each of you your opinion of the other.
What the devil do you mean by that?
The crime was most probably committed by a woman. It has all the marks of that.
You can't possibly suspect Miss Debenham.
As an Englishman, you can perceive things about her that I cannot. What sort of person is she, Colonel?
You seem to have some very peculiar notions of the way English people behave. Miss Debenham is a lady.
And therefore she could not possibly be implicated in this crime?
The very idea is absurd. The man was a perfect stranger. She had never seen him before.
Did she tell you this?
Not in so many words. She commented on his somewhat unpleasant appearance. If a woman really is concerned, though I can't imagine on what assumption you could have come to that conclusion, Miss Debenham is most certainly not the person you are looking for.
Very well. Let us pass on to matters of fact. We have reason to believe that the crime was committed at 1:15 last night. It is part of our necessary routine to ask everyone on the train what he or she was doing at the time.
Well, to the best of my recollection, at 1:15, I was talking to that young American fellow, McQueen, the secretary to the dead man. We were in his compartment.
He was a friend or acquaintance of yours?
Never saw him before he got on this train. We got talking about India, and he seemed to have some very peculiar notions about how we run the place. I thought it my duty to set him to rights. We went on talking till nearly 2:00.
I believe that you got out when the train stopped at Vinkovtsi, is that so?
We both did, McQueen and I, that is. But only for about a minute. The cold was something frightful. Made me quite grateful to get back to the fug. Though, as a rule, I think these trains are scandalously overheated.
It is very difficult to please everyone. The English, they open everything, then others come along and close everything. What is one to do?
I can't understand why you fellows have such a rooted objection to fresh air.
Yes, now, Colonel, cast your mind back. You and Mr. McQueen return to the train. You sit down and smoke. Perhaps a cigarette, perhaps a pipe.
A pipe, for me. McQueen smokes cigarettes.
You carry on with your talk about the British Empire. It is late now. Many people have retired for the night. Did anyone pass your door? Now, think carefully.
It's difficult to say. The conductor went by and... Oh, wait a minute. There was a woman, I think.
A woman?
Can you describe her? Was she old or young?
I didn't see her. Just heard a rustle as she went by. And a scent of some sort.
What kind of scent? Can you describe it?
Well, it was rather fruity, if you know what I mean. The kind of thing you could smell 100 yards away. And then again, it was one of those things that you notice without noticing, if you know what I mean.
I know. Now tell me, Colonel, have you ever been in America?
Never. No desire to go there, either.
Did you ever know a Colonel Armstrong?
I've known 2 or 3. It was a chap called Selby Armstrong, got blown to pieces at Passchendaele.
No, no, no. I mean the Colonel Armstrong who married the daughter of the American actress Linda Arden and whose only child was kidnapped and killed.
I never actually came across him, but I know who you mean, of course. Toby Armstrong. Everybody liked him. A very distinguished soldier. He got the VC.
The man who was killed last night was the man responsible for the murder of Colonel Armstrong's child.
Then he deserved what was coming to him. But I'd sooner have seen him hanged, or put in the electric chair.
Do you prefer law and order to private vengeance?
A man ought to be put on trial and judged by a properly constituted jury. I don't know of a better system.
Yes, I can see that that would be your view. Well, I do not think that there is anything else I need ask you, Colonel.
There's something I've just remembered.
Yes, Colonel, what is it?
Maybe nothing at all. But when I left McQueen and got back to my compartment, I noticed that the door of the one beyond mine, the end one, you know...
Yes, number 16.
Well, the door of it was not quite closed, and the fellow inside peered out in a furtive sort of way. Then he quickly pulled the door to. Well, there's probably nothing in it, but it struck me as rather odd at the time.
Thank you, Colonel. That is most interesting.
Yeah, I'll be on my way, then. By the way, about Miss Debenham.
Mm-hmm.
You can take it from me that she's all right. She's Pakasab. Good day, gentlemen.
What does he mean, Pakasab?
It means that Miss Debenham's father and brothers were at the same kind of school as Colonel Arbuthnot.
I see. Then it has nothing to do with the crime at all. What about the man who the Colonel saw peering round the door of his compartment?
Number 16? Who is the passenger in number 16?
Mr. Cyrus Hardman. He looks just like a gangster, but according to his passport, he's a travelling salesman for a company which sells typewriter ribbons.
I think we should have him in next.
I think I'd better come clean. I've heard of you, Mr. Poirot. You've got quite a reputation in our profession.
In our profession? Typewriter ribbons?
The passport's a bit of a bluff, I'm afraid. I work for McNeil's detective agency in New York.
Huh. I think you had better explain, Mr. Hardman.
I've been trailing a couple of dope smugglers. The trail went cold in Istanbul. I was going to go home with my tail between my legs when I got this letter.
Hmm? You have been pointed out to me as an operator for the McNeil Detective Agency. Kindly report to my suite at the Tocatlian Hotel at 4 o'clock this afternoon. S.E. Ratchet.
He was a worried man, Mr. Poirot. He showed me a couple of letters that someone had sent to him. He wanted me to travel on the train back to Paris with him and see that nobody got him. I guess I didn't make out any too well.
Did he give you any precise instructions?
His idea was that I should travel in the compartment alongside his, but it was booked. The only place I could get was number 16, but I figured it was in a good strategic position. The only way a killer could come was through the rear-end door to the platform. He would have to pass right by my compartment.
Did he give you any idea why his life was being threatened?
No. He just said someone was out for his blood.
You knew who he really was, of course. You recognized him.
I don't get you.
Ratchet was Cassetti, the Armstrong kidnapper.
Cassetti? No, Mr. Poirot, I didn't know. I was way out west at the time of the kidnapping. I suppose I must have seen photographs of him in the papers, but I wouldn't recognize my own mother when a press photographer had done with her.
Very true, Mr. Hardman.
I'm not surprised someone had it in for Ratchet.
Did he give you any clue as to the identity of the person who was threatening him?
Well, I know what he looked like. Mr. Ratchet described him to me.
He described him?
Yeah, he told me to be on the lookout for a small man, dark, with a high-pitched, womanish kind of voice.
A small, dark man?
Yeah, he said he didn't think that he would strike on the first night out.
A small, dark man with a womanish voice?
That's the way he described him.
Thank you, Mr. Hardman. You have been of great assistance to us.
Oh, it's good to know that, Mr. Poirot. If there is anything at all I can do, don't hesitate to ask me. You know where to find me.
A little dark man with a high-pitched voice? There is no one on the train even remotely like that.
Exactly.
So all our calculations are wrong. We shall have to go back to the beginning.
Not so, my friend. I have an idea that this little man with a woman's voice is someone we are going to meet again.
But who can he possibly be?
For the first time, I begin to have a glimpse of what may have happened last night. The little man who could not have been on the train. The mysterious lady in the red kimono who was in Ratchet's compartment.
What about them?
The pipe cleaner. The woman's handkerchief. The watch that stopped so conveniently. It is a very amusing little game that is being played for our benefit. Within a very little time, my friend, I shall be able to tell you who committed the murder on the Orient Express. Hercule Poirot is not so easily fooled.
So, Monsieur Poirot, the murderer is most probably a member of the Armstrong family.
Yes, Dr. Constantine, it is a strong possibility.
But we have found no direct connection with the family, apart from the Princess Dagomirov.
Who, in any case, would not have had the strength to deliver such a fatal blow.
Which of the passengers have we not yet interviewed?
Eh bien, the Princess Dagomirov's maid, Hildegard Schmidt, Miss Debenham, who seems to interest you so much, and the Italian, Foscarelli. I think you should interview the Italian.
Very well, Monsieur Bouc. Since you are convinced that this is the kind of murder that only an excitable Latin could have committed, let us get it over with and talk to Signor Foscarelli.
Of course I have been in America. Many, many times. You see, I am an agent for the Fortecars, so naturally I go to America. It was there that I discovered my natural genius for salesmanship. Ernest Potter, you must have heard of him. He is very big in Detroit. He says to me, Foscarelli, he say, in all of my born days...
Yeah, in your many journeys to the United States, did you ever meet the murdered man, Mr. Ratchet?
Never, but I know the type. Very respectable, very well addressed, but underneath it all, something is wrong. Out of my experience, I should say he is a crook. I give you my opinion for what it is worth.
You are quite right. Ratchet was Cassetti, the kidnapper.
Heh! What did I tell you?
You remember the Armstrong case?
I do not quite remember. It was a little girl, was it not? A terrible thing. But even in a great civilization like America...
Did you ever come across any members of the Armstrong family?
I come across so many people. In a week I sell 20 or 30 cars, which means at least 30 or 40 people. I cannot remember every single one.
Now tell me, if you please, your exact movements last night from dinner onwards.
With pleasure. I stay here, in the dining car, as long as I can. I talk to the American gentleman at my table.
And Mr. Hardman.
That's right. He sells the typewriter ribbons, just imagine. And then I go back to my compartment. It is empty. The miserable English servant who shares it with me is away attending his master, the kidnapper. At last he comes back, pulling a long face, as usual. He will not talk. Simply says yes and no. They're a miserable race, the English. He sits in the corner very stiff and reads a woman's novel. Then the conductor comes and makes our beds.
Which was your berth?
The one on the top. I get up there, I smoke, I read. The little Englishman has, I think, the toothache. He gets out a bottle of stuff that smells very strong. Presently I sleep. Whenever I wake, I hear him groaning.
Do you know if he left the compartment during the night?
No, I do not think so. I would certainly have heard him.
Did he ever speak of his master, Mr. Ratchet?
But he never speak of anything. He is not a simpatico. He's a fish. Is that all?
For the time being, yes. Thank you, Signor Foscarelli.
Allora, good day to you, gentlemen.
Well, my friend... What do you think of your principal suspect?
I don't like him. He's a big mouth.
Perhaps, but that does not make him a murderer. I do not think this is a Latin crime of passion. It is too far-sighted. It is a crime that shows traces of a cool, resourceful, deliberate brain. I think an Anglo-Saxon brain. Perhaps it is time that we saw the English governess, Miss Debenham.
I'm afraid I have nothing at all to tell you. I simply went to bed and slept.
Does it distress you very much, mademoiselle, that a crime should have been committed on this train?
I haven't really thought about it from that point of view. No, I can't say that I'm at all distressed.
You are very Anglo-Saxon, are you not, Miss Debenham? You do not make a show of the emotions.
I don't see why I should put on a fit of hysterics to prove my sensibility. After all, people die every day.
They die, yes. But murder is a little more unusual. Were you acquainted with the dead man?
I saw him for the first time when taking lunch in here yesterday.
And how did he strike you?
I hardly noticed him.
Did he impress you as an evil personality?
I can't really say that I thought about it.
You are, I think, a little contemptuous of the way I go about my inquiries. This is not the way it would be conducted in England, you think?
Seems a complete waste of time. Whether or not I like Mr. Ratchett's features does not seem to me likely to be helpful in finding out who killed him.
Do you know who this Mr. Ratchett really was?
Mrs. Hubbard has been telling everybody.
And what do you think of the Armstrong affair?
It's quite abominable. Disgusting.
Now tell me, mademoiselle, do you intend to return to Baghdad after your holiday in England?
I'm not sure.
Why is that?
Baghdad is rather out of things. I think I should prefer a post in London if I hear of a suitable one.
I see. No, I thought perhaps you might be going to get married.
I don't think that's any of your business.
Tell me, what is your opinion of the lady who shares your compartment, Miss Olson?
She seems a pleasant, simple creature.
What colour is her dressing gown?
Kind of brownish colour. Natural wool.
And your own?
Pale mauve.
You do not have a scarlet dressing gown, for example?
No, that is not mine.
Whose then?
How should I know?
You said that is not mine, implying that such a thing does belong to someone else.
That is so.
Whose is it?
I don't know. I woke up this morning at 5 o'clock with a feeling that the train had been standing still for a long time. I opened the door and looked out into the corridor, thinking we might be in a station. I saw someone in a scarlet kimono some way down the corridor.
And do you have any idea who it was? Was she fair or dark?
I can't say. She was wearing a shingle cap, and I only saw the back of her head.
And her build?
Tallish and slim, I should judge, but it's difficult to say. The kimono was embroidered with dragons.
Dragons, just so.
Will that be all?
Yes, I need not keep you further, mademoiselle.
Then I shall return to my compartment.
Thank you.
I do not quite understand, my friend. What were you trying to do?
I was looking for a flaw.
A flaw?
Yes, in the armor of that young lady's self-possession. I wanted to shake her sang-froid. Did I succeed? I do not know.
But why should you wish to do that?
She seems a charming young lady. The last person in the world to be involved in a crime of this kind.
Oh, Lala, you must, both of you, rid yourselves of the obsession that this is a sudden, unpremeditated crime. I suspect Miss Debenham for two reasons. The first is that conversation I overheard from the Taurus Express. You will remember, Monsieur Bouc, I told you that she used the words, "When it's all over, when it's all behind us."
But that doesn't make her a murderess. It could have meant anything.
What is your other reason?
Because she has just the kind of cool, intelligent, resourceful brain to have planned this crime.
I'm sure you are completely wrong, my friend. She's certainly not the criminal type.
Ah, well, let us talk to the final name on our list. The princess's maid, Hildegard Schmidt. Could you ask Pierre Michel to get her?
Oh, no. There was nothing unusual about the princess sending for me during the night. She sleeps badly, and sometimes she is in pain.
And what time would this have been?
I do not know, monsieur. I was asleep. The attendant came to wake me.
And you got up and put on your red dressing gown.
What makes you think I have a red dressing gown? Mine is dark blue. In any case, Her Excellency would not have liked me to attend her in my dressing gown. I put on my clothes.
You must forgive my little joke. And what did you do when you got there?
I massaged her neck and shoulders, and I read aloud to her for a little while. But it was very cold in spite of the heating. I went to get the princess a rug from my compartment. I put it over her, poured out a little mineral water, turned out the light, and returned to my own compartment.
And did you meet anyone in the corridor?
There was the conductor, of course.
And what was he doing?
He came out of one of the compartments, monsieur.
Which one? Can you tell us?
It was about the middle of the coach, monsieur, 2 or 3 doors down from Madame la Princesse. He nearly ran into me.
When was this?
When I was returning from my compartment with the rug.
And he came out of the compartment and collided with you. In which direction was he going?
Towards the dining car, monsieur. A bell began ringing, but I do not think he went to answer it.
Ah, the poor conductor must have had a heavy night. First waking you and then running about answering bells.
Oh, no. It was not the same conductor as the one who woke me. It was another one.
Had you seen him before?
No, monsieur.
Do you think you could recognize him again?
I think so.
I think we should have all the conductors in here at once.
I agree. If you would be so kind, Monsieur Bourgoin.
I will see to it straight away.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been in America, Fräulein Schmidt?
Never, monsieur.
You have already heard, perhaps, who the murdered man really was?
Yes, I have heard. The good God should not allow such things. But he has seen that justice is done.
Tell me, is this your handkerchief, Fräulein Schmidt? It has the letter H, you see.
That is a lady's handkerchief, a very expensive one. It is hand-embroidered. It comes from Paris, I imagine.
Do you perhaps know whose it is?
I? No, monsieur.
Par ici. Come this way, monsieur. These are the three sleeping car conductors, Fräulein Schmidt.
Now, will you be so kind as to tell us which is the one you met last night when you were going with the rug to the princess?
There must be some mistake.
What do you mean?
None of these men is the conductor I saw last night.
But these are the only conductors on the train.
These are big, tall men. The man I saw last night was small and very dark. He had a little moustache, and he had a high little weak voice, almost like a woman's. I am certain of it.
Surely someone must get here soon. They can't just leave us marooned out here forever.
I said that we should hear again about this small, dark man with a womanish voice. It is the person Ratchet told Hardman to be on the lookout for. Mrs. Hubbard found a wagon lee button in her room.
But if this man exists, where is he now?
Every part of the train has been searched most thoroughly.
Then he can only be a passenger on the train or in disguise.
But there is no man of that size or shape on the train.
So, we have two mysterious strangers, the wagon lee conductor and the woman in the red kimono. Who are these two people? And, incidentally, where are the wagon-lee uniform and the red kimono?
We must search the passengers' luggage. They won't like it, but I don't see that we have any alternative.
You are right. But I will make a prophecy.
You know where they are?
You will find the scarlet kimono in the baggage of one of the men, and you will find the wagon-lee uniform in a suitcase belonging to Hildegard Schmidt.
But she struck me as being an utterly harmless person.
No, my friend. That is not what I meant. If Hildegard Schmidt is guilty, the uniform might be found in her baggage. But if she is innocent, it certainly will be.
Oh, man!
What?
Help!
What on earth is going on?
Oh, Mr. Poirot! Where's Mr. Poirot?
I am here, Mrs. Hubbard. What has happened?
It's horrible. It's just too horrible. It's in my sponge bag.
What about your sponge bag, madame? What is in it?
I can't tell you. It's too awful.
I think perhaps, Monsieur Bouc, if you were to give Mrs. Hubbard a little cognac.
Yes,
I'm a lifelong teetotaler. I never touch spirits.
Nevertheless, madame, you have obviously had a great shock, and I think you should...
Well, if it's strictly medical.
But of course, madame.
Of course. Good. I shall go and inspect the lady's sponge bag. I would be grateful if you would accompany me, Dr. Constantine.
But what about Mrs. Hubbard?
Oh, cognac will work wonders. And I think it is most important for you to come with me.
Very well.
Not too much, mind. Only a little drop.
It is as I expected, Doctor. Take a close look at it. Could it be the murder weapon?
A straight-bladed dagger.
Stained, as you see, with blood.
It is almost certainly the dagger which was used to kill Ratchet. It could account for almost any of the wounds.
So, the sponge bag was hanging on the door handle. How curious.
We locked the door from the other side, you remember?
Yes, that is true.
It agrees, does it not? The murderer passes through this carriage. As he shuts the communicating door behind him, he feels the sponge bag, and he slips the dagger inside it. Then he goes out through the other door into the corridor.
As you say, that is how it must have happened. And yet, Mrs. Hubbard said she could not see the bolt because of the sponge bag.
I can't possibly spend another night in that compartment. I'd rather sleep in the corridor. If my daughter could see me now,
Madame,
she'd be...
No one could possibly allow you to spend another night there. Your baggage shall be taken immediately to another compartment in the Belgrade coach.
One moment, if you please. There is a little matter of routine. You permit, Madame, that I make a search of your baggage?
Whatever for?
We are about to carry out an inspection of all the passengers' luggage. I do not need to remind you of your recent most unpleasant experience, your sponge bag.
Mercy on us. Don't let me stop you, Monsieur Poirot. I just couldn't stand another shock like that. Go ahead. Search everything.
This may well be a complete waste of time and effort. Nothing in Mrs. Hubbard's luggage, nothing in Hartmann's, nothing in the Princess Dragomirov's. And as for Colonel Arbuthnot...
The pipe cleaners.
Which were identical with the one we found on the floor of Ratchet's compartment. But it is not in the Colonel's character to commit a murder in that fashion. And when you have said that, you have said everything.
So, who is next?
The Comte and Comtesse Andreny.
Ooh, that may be extremely awkward. They hold diplomatic passports. Their luggage is exempt from examination.
By the customs, yes. But a murder inquiry is different.
All the same, we don't wish to cause complications.
Now, do not distress yourself, my friend. It will not cause trouble for the company de Varonly. The Comte and Comtesse will be reasonable. At any rate, let us make an attempt.
Entrez.
Pardon, Monsieur le Comte, Madame la Comtesse. Pray forgive this intrusion. It is necessary for us to make a search of all the baggage on this train. In most cases it is a mere formality, but I am afraid that it has to be done. Monsieur Bouc has suggested that as you hold a diplomatic passport, you may reasonably claim to be exempt from such a search.
It is very considerate of you, Monsieur Bouc. But I don't think that I care for an exception to be made in my case.
Oh, Monsieur le Comte is most accommodating.
I should prefer that our baggage be examined, like that of the other passengers. You do not object, I hope, Elena?
Not at all. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madame la Comtesse. This is your suitcase?
Yes, it is.
Oh, the label on it is wet. It must be something to do with the condensation.
What else can you expect with snow on every side?
It is a mere formality, mademoiselle, but nevertheless it is necessary. With your permission, Miss Debenham?
Oh, go ahead. Here are the keys.
You are most understanding. Miss Olson?
Oh, yes, of course, if you say it's necessary.
You have become a good friend of Mrs. Hubbard, have you not?
Yes.
We have moved her into another compartment in the next coach, but she is still very upset as a consequence of finding the dagger in her sponge bag. Oh. I have ordered coffee to be sent to her, but I think she needs someone to talk to.
Oh, poor lady, of course I will go to her. It must have been terrible shock. I will take some smelling salts. They are there. Could you pass them?
There you are, mademoiselle.
Thank you. My case is not locked.
Why did you send her away?
I do not understand you, Miss Devon.
You wanted to get me alone, wasn't that it?
Mademoiselle, we have a proverb...
A qui s'excuse, s'accuse. Is that what you were going to say? You must give me credit for a certain amount of observation and common sense. For some reason or other, you've got it into your head that I know something about this sordid business.
This is your suitcase?
Yes, it is.
Well, I will not beat about the bush. I shall ask you to tell me the meaning of certain words I heard you speak when you and Colonel Arbuthnot got out of the Taurus Express to stretch the legs, as you call it, at Konya. You said to him, not now, when it's all over, when it's behind us. What did you mean by those words, Miss Debenham?
Do you think I meant murder?
It is I who am asking you.
Those words had a meaning, but not one that I can tell you. I can only give you my solemn word of honour that I have never set eyes on this man, Ratchet, in my life until I saw him on this train.
And you refuse to explain those words?
If you like to put it that way. The words were private. They had to do with a task that I'd undertaken.
A task that is now ended?
What do you mean?
It is ended, is it not?
Why should you think so?
Let me recall you to another incident. There was a delay to the train on the day we were due to reach Istanbul. You, normally so calm, so self-controlled, were very agitated.
I didn't want to miss my connection.
But the Orient Express runs every day of the week. Why was it so important to be on this particular train?
You don't seem to realize that one may have friends awaiting one's arrival in London, that a day's delay upsets arrangements and causes a lot of annoyance.
Ah, just like that. Yet now, when we are trapped here in the snow, your manner is quite different. You are calm, philosophical almost. You do not answer, mademoiselle.
Don't you think you're making rather a fuss about nothing, Monsieur Poirot?
It is perhaps a fault with us detectives. We expect the behaviour to be always consistent.
Have you finished examining my luggage?
Oh, thank you, yes. You still refuse to tell me the meaning of those words, when it's behind us?
I have nothing more to say.
Ah. It does not matter. I shall find out. Good day, Miss Devlin.
And I found nothing in McQueen's luggage, or Masterman's, or Foscarelli's.
Which leaves us only with Fräulein Schmidt.
Yes, monsieur?
Forgive us disturbing you, Fräulein Schmidt, but we are making a search of the passenger's luggage.
Of course. Come in.
Perhaps we could start with the suitcase on the rack.
As you wish.
I will get it down.
Do you have the keys, Fräulein Schmidt?
It is not locked. To leave a god! What on earth is that doing there?
You remember my little prophecy, monsieur Bouc? The wagon lit uniform. Oh,
but that is not mine. I did not put it there. I've not opened that suitcase since we left Istanbul.
Now, do not be agitated. We believe you. I am sure you did not hide the uniform, as I am sure you are a good cook. You are a good cook, I know.
I believe so. All my ladies have said that I am.
How could the uniform have got there?
I will tell you what happened. This man, the man you saw in the Vangoli uniform, comes out of the dead man's compartment. He collides with you, and of course he had hoped that no one would see him. He must get rid of the uniform. He watches you go into the princess's compartment, and he knows that yours will be empty. He slips in, removes the uniform, and puts it into your suitcase.
Yes, that is how it must have happened.
And then?
That we have to find out.
You see here? A button is missing.
Mm-hmm.
The button that was found in Mrs. Hubbard's compartment. And in the pocket, a conductor's pass key. Here is the explanation of how our man was able to go through locked doors. With this key, he could go anywhere.
One mystery remains. The scarlet kimono. We have not found it.
It is indeed a mystery.
Well, there is nothing more to be found here at any rate. Thank you, Fräulein Schmidt. And do not worry yourself.
I do not see how I can help it, monsieur.
We may as well go back to the dining car. We know now all that we can know. We have the evidence of the passengers, the evidence of our eyes. We need now to turn over all these facts in our brains. To use our little grey cells. Perhaps you might ask Dr. Constantine to join us.
If you think it necessary.
Most certainly. I will be with you in a moment. I need the cigarettes from my compartment.
Ah, someone appears to be taking an interest in us at last.
An army aircraft. Well, that should make him take notice of us.
He's dipping his wings. Well, at least they know that we are here. It makes it even more urgent to clear up this business before the police arrive.
Ah, Monsieur Poirot.
You cannot imagine what I found in my compartment, neatly folded up on top of my suitcase. A scarlet kimono embroidered with dragons. It is a challenge, a defiance, and Hercule Poirot will take it up.
But where on earth does one start?
We found nothing in the passenger's luggage that we were not intended to find. And as for their evidence, it told us nothing at all.
Oh, yes. There were one or two points of interest.
Oui, I didn't notice anything.
Do you remember, for instance, what young Mr. McQueen said about his employer, Mr. Ratchett? He was hampered by knowing no languages.
Oui, what of it?
You do not see?
When the conductor Michel answered Mr. Ratchett's bell, didn't Ratchett reply to him in French?
Bravo, Doctor. He said, ce n'est rien. Je me suis trompé. I heard the voice myself.
You heard the voice? But you mean it may not have been that of Ratchet?
Ah.
Now I understand your reluctance to accept the evidence of the broken watch. Already at 23 minutes to 1, Ratchet was dead.
And the voice you heard was that of his murderer.
No. Let us not go too fast. And do not let us assume more than we know. Let us approach the case from an entirely different angle. How was the murder intended to appear to everybody?
You mean, if we had not run into the snow drift?
Exactly, Doctor.
The murder would probably not have been discovered until we reached the Italian frontier, which would have been early this morning, but for the snow.
And the evidence would have been given to the Italian police. Mr. McQueen would have produced the threatening letters. Mr. Hardman would have told them that Ratchet had told him to be on the lookout for a little man with a high-pitched voice. Mrs. Hubbard would have been eager to tell how the murderer had been in her compartment. The button would have been found.
You mean that the murder was planned to look like an outside job?
Exactly. What time was the train scheduled to arrive at Broad?
At 1:58 in the morning.
Then the assassin would have been presumed to have got off the train at Broad. Somebody would probably have noticed a strange little wagon-lit conductor passing down the corridor. No suspicion would have been attached to any of the passengers. The murderer would have been the man Hardman had been told to look for.
But where does all this get us? We are no nearer to finding the killers.
Oh, no. We are very close now. We must first distinguish between the clues which were deliberately planted for us to find and those which were not. The pipe cleaner and the button were part of a little charade, but the handkerchief and the burnt letter were not.
But why was the letter written in the first place?
You have perhaps read the novel of Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island?
When I was a child.
You remember the black spot?
A notice of execution.
A warning that a death sentence had been passed.
And the letter was destroyed so that no one would connect the killing with the Armstrong family.
But we have been over all this before, and with the exception of the Princesse d'Agomirov, there is no one even remotely connected with the Armstrong family.
That is what we are intended to believe. But the evidence of the handkerchief may prove otherwise.
But surely, since that person knows that we have the handkerchief, she would do anything in her power to conceal her name.
You would make quite a competent detective, Doctor. And there is one person on this train who has done just that.
But tell us.
Oh, please, please.
No, you must preserve your patience until after dinner, my friends. I have observed that she is always the last person to leave the dining car.
The dining car? Oh, mon Dieu. Thank goodness you have reminded me. I must talk to the chef.
Pardon, madame. I think you have dropped your handkerchief.
You are mistaken, monsieur. That is not my handkerchief.
Are you sure of that, madame la comtesse?
Perfectly sure.
And yet it has your initial, the letter H.
I do not understand you, monsieur. My initials are E.A.
I think you are not telling me the truth.
How dare you!
That was why you concealed your real initials on your passport with a spot of grease. And why you covered your initials on your suitcase with a new label. A label which was still wet when I examined your luggage. Your name is Helena, not Elena. You are Helena Goldenberg, the younger daughter of Linda Arden. Helena Goldenberg, the sister of Sonia Armstrong, whose child the dead man, Ratchet, kidnapped and murdered. It is useless to deny it, madame. You are Helena Goldenberg, the sister of Sonia Armstrong.
I'm not denying it. Yes, I am Sonia's sister.
You did not acquaint me with that fact when I questioned you earlier, madame la comtesse.
No, I did not.
In fact, everything that you and your husband have told me was a tissue of lies.
Monsieur, I cannot allow you
no,
to speak...
No, Rudolph. Monsieur Poirot puts the facts rather brutally, but what he says is undeniable.
I am glad you admit the fact so freely, madame. Will you now tell me your reasons for doing so and for obscuring your Christian name on your passport?
That was my doing entirely.
Surely, Monsieur Poirot, you can guess my reason. The man who was killed is the man who murdered my baby niece, who killed my sister, who broke my brother-in-law's heart. Of all the people on this train, I alone had the best motive for killing him.
And did you kill him, madame?
I swear to you, Monsieur Poirot, that much as I may have been tempted to it, I never lifted a hand against the man.
I too.
I give you my word of honor that last night Elena never left her compartment. She took a sleeping pill exactly as I said. She is totally innocent.
Then how do you explain the presence of your wife's handkerchief in the dead man's compartment?
That handkerchief is not mine.
In spite of the initial H?
In spite of the initial.
But after so many lies, how can I know that you are telling me the truth?
I know that I cannot hope to make you believe me. But I assure you that it is so. The handkerchief is not mine.
Then why did you alter the name on your passport?
Because we heard that the handkerchief had been found with the initial H on it.
I couldn't bear the thought of having the kidnapping raked up again, and to be suspected and perhaps thrown into prison. I was scared stiff, Monsieur Poirot. Can't you understand?
If I am inclined to believe you, madame, then you must help me.
Help you?
Yes. The reason for the murder lies in the past, in that tragedy which broke up your home and destroyed your young life. Take me back into the past, that I may find there the link that will explain the whole thing.
But what can there be to tell you?
There was another victim, madame. An indirect victim, you might say.
Poor Suzanne. The nursemaid? Yes, I had forgotten about her. The police were convinced that she had something to do with it. She thought she was being held responsible. She threw herself out of the window. It was horrible.
There was a nurse, too, I think.
Yes, there was. I think her name was Stringlebert, something like that. She was devoted to Daisy and to my sister.
You were a young girl at the time. Did you have no one to superintend your studies?
Oh, yes, I had a governess, a red-haired Scotch woman. She was a frightful dragon.
What was her name?
Miss Freebody.
Huh. Young or old?
She seemed frightfully old to me. I suppose she couldn't have been more than 40.
And there were no other inmates in the house?
Only the servants.
Are you certain? Quite certain, madame, that you have recognized no one on the train?
No one, monsieur. No one at all.
Do you hear that? That is coming from the other side of the barrier of snow. Rescue is on its way, mes amis.
Which means that the Yugoslav police will be on their way, too.
You are quite right, Doctor. There is no time to be lost. How long do you think it will take the snowplows to get through to us, Monsieur Bouc?
A matter of hours.
The princess is coming.
Huh?
Monsieur Poirot, oh, pray, be seated, gentlemen. Monsieur Poirot, I believe that you have a handkerchief of mine.
Is this it, madame?
Yes, it is. It has my initial in the corner.
But, Madame la Princesse, it is the letter H. I understood that your name was Natalia.
That is correct, monsieur. My handkerchiefs are always initialed in the Russian characters. H is N in Russian.
But you did not tell me that the handkerchief was yours when we talked earlier.
You need not make a lengthy business of this, monsieur. Your next question will be, how did my handkerchief come to be lying next to the murdered man's body? My reply is that I have no idea.
You will excuse me, madame, but how much can we rely upon the truthfulness of your replies?
Is this because I did not tell you I knew that Hélène Andréni was Mrs. Armstrong's sister?
It was a deliberate lie, madame.
Of course it was. Her mother was my friend. I believe in loyalty to one's friends, to one's family, and to one's caste.
You do not believe in doing your utmost to further the cause of justice?
No one paid much heed to the cause of justice when Cassetti walked from that court a free man. But now, I believe that justice, a strict justice, has been done.
Lies and still more lies. It amazes me the amount of lies we had told to us this morning.
There are still more to discover.
So, who do we tackle next?
We question the Pucker Sahib, Colonel Arbuthnot.
I don't imagine he will be very pleased.
It could easily be one of my pipe cleaners. I don't put a private mark on them.
Do you know where it was found?
Not the least idea.
It was found by the body of the murdered man. Can you tell us how it is likely to have got there?
If you mean, did I drop it there myself? No, I didn't. I never even spoke to the fellow.
You mean you never spoke to him and you did not murder him?
If I had, I should hardly be likely to acquaint you with the fact. As a matter of fact, I didn't murder Ratchet.
Ah, well, it is of no consequence.
I beg your pardon?
It is of no consequence. What I really wished to ask you about was quite another matter. Miss Debenham may have told you, perhaps, that I overheard some words she spoke to you at the station of Konya. She said, not now, when it's all over, when it's all behind us. Can you tell us what she meant by that?
I'm sorry, but I must refuse to answer that question.
You will not give away a lady's secret?
You can put it that way, if you like.
Miss Debenham told me that the words referred to a private matter of her own.
Then why not take her word for it?
Because, Colonel, Miss Debenham is what one might call a highly suspicious character.
That's nonsense. You have nothing whatever against her.
Not the fact that Miss Debenham was companion governess in the Armstrong household at the time of the kidnapping of little Daisy Armstrong. You see, Colonel, we know more than you think. If Miss Debenham is innocent, why did she conceal the fact? Why did she tell me that she had never been in America?
Why don't you ask her?
That, my dear Colonel, is precisely what I am going to do.
Yes, it's true. I did lie to you.
Ah, you admit it?
Certainly, since you found me out.
You are at least frank, mademoiselle.
There doesn't seem anything else for me to be.
And why did you lie to me?
I should have thought the reason leapt to the eye, Monsieur Poirot.
Does not leap to mine.
I have my living to get.
What has that to do with it?
What do you know of the struggle to get and keep a decent situation? Do you think a woman who has been detained in connection with a murder case and whose photograph has probably appeared in all the English papers, do you think that any nice, ordinary English middle-class woman would want to engage that person as a governess to her daughters? Why should I put my whole future at risk when no good could have been served?
I would have thought that I would have been the best judge of that, not you. You will not tell me your secret, mademoiselle?
I can't. I can't. You don't want me any more, do you, Monsieur Poirot? I shan't run away.
Another miraculous guess. My dear friend, you really are quite astonishing.
Oh, I claim no credit this time. Countess Saint Renier practically told me.
But the woman the Countess described as her governess was nothing like Miss Debenham. She said she was a middle-aged Scotswoman with red hair.
The exact opposite in every respect. And then she had to invent a name for her on the spur of the moment, and it was the unconscious association of ideas that gave her away. She called her Miss Freebody, you remember?
Yes.
In London there is a store called Debenham and Freebody. With the name Debenham running in her head, she clutches at the first name that comes to mind. Freebody.
Oh. Nothing could surprise me now. Even if everybody on the train turned out to have been in the Armstrong household, I should not so much as blink.
That is a very profound remark. Would you like to see what your favorite suspect, the Italian, has to say for himself?
Yes, sir. I was at the Armstrongs, the chauffeur. But I had nothing to do with this business last night. I never left the carriage. You cannot prove anything against me.
Very good. You can go.
That pig! He should have gone to the electric chair anyway. Did you know the American police tried to pin it on me?
But it was not you. You had nothing to do with the kidnapping of the child.
Oh, you know, you could not understand. That little girl was the light of the whole house. Tonio, she called me. I'm going to drive the car now, Tonio, she would say. And she would sit on my lap and I hold the wheel. How could anyone do such a thing to her?
I do understand. You may go.
She was an angel. A little angel.
My head is spinning. It is not possible. Who are you going to call now?
The Swedish lady, Miss Olsen.
But how can she be involved in all this?
You remember the trained nurse who worked with the Armstrong household?
That poor child, she knew nothing but kindness and love. If you'd been there, if you'd lived through that terrible tragedy. I know I should have told you the truth about myself, but I was afraid because I rejoiced that that evil man was dead.
I understand everything. I will ask you no more questions. It is enough that you have admitted what I knew to be the truth. Go now, mademoiselle.
Poor woman.
One begins to understand how unutterably evil this man must have been.
I hope that I'm not intruding, sir.
Not in the least. What is it that you have to say, Mr. Masterman?
I thought it best to come along at once, sir, and tell you the truth.
And what is that?
I was Colonel Armstrong's batman during the war, sir. And afterwards, I was his valet when the family was living in New York. I'm afraid I concealed the fact this morning. It was very wrong of me, sir, and I thought I'd better come along and make a clean breast of it.
Very right and proper, Mr. Masterman. Is that all you have to say?
That is all, sir.
Thank you. You may go.
I just had to get it off my conscience, sir.
Of the 12 passengers in that coach, 9 have been proved to have a connection with the Armstrong family, but which of them is the murderer?
Ah, my friend, I fear you do not understand at all. Tell me, do you really not know who killed Ratchet?
Do you?
I think that it is time now that we assembled all the passengers together.
I will ask Michel to arrange it.
Ah, yes, Michel. It is essential that he is there too.
Michel? You mean he too is involved in this? Oh, it is impossible. Where will it all end?
The passengers are all gathered in the dining car, Monsieur Bouc.
Ah, thank you, Michel. What's happening outside?
They're getting up steam on the engine.
Does that mean the line is clear?
The snowplows are only a few hundred meters away. The track should be clear within the hour.
Then the sooner this little matter is cleared up, the better. If you would care to go ahead, Monsieur Poirot.
Mesdames et messieurs, we are here, as you know, to investigate the killing of Samuel Edward Ratchet Cassetti. I have considered the matter very carefully, and I have come to the conclusion that there are 2 possible explanations of the crime.
2?
I shall put both of them before you, and I shall ask Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine here to judge which solution is the right one.
Very well.
Now, you all know the facts of the case. Mr. Ratchet was found stabbed this morning. He was last known to be alive at 12:37 last night when he spoke to the wagon-lee conductor through the door. A watch in his pajama pocket was found to be badly dented, and it had stopped at 1:15. What did you consider the time of death to be after your examination, Doctor?
Between midnight and 2 in the morning.
At 30 minutes after midnight, as you all know, the train ran into a snowdrift. After that time, it was impossible for anyone to leave the train. We are therefore forced to the conclusion that the murderer is to be found among the occupants of one particular coach, the Stamboul-Calais coach. That, as I say, was our theory.
What do you mean, Monsieur Poirot?
I will put before you an alternative theory. It is very simple. Mr. Ratchet had a certain enemy whom he feared. Perhaps you would describe him to us, Mr. Harnan.
Sure. He said to look out for a small, dark man with a womanish voice.
Now, it is my belief that Mr. Ratchet knew a good deal more than he told. The enemy, as he expected, joined the train at Belgrade, or possibly at Vinkovci. He wore a wagon-lee uniform over his ordinary clothes and had a pass key which enabled him to gain access to Mr. Ratchet's compartment. The man stabbed Ratchet with great ferocity and left through the communicating door to Miss Hubbard's compartment.
And to think that at first nobody would believe me.
He slipped out into the corridor, put his uniform into Fräulein Schmidt's suitcase, and he left the train just before it pulled out of Vinkovci.
But what about the watch?
There you have the explanation for the whole thing. Mr. Ratchet had omitted to put his watch back an hour, as he should have done at Sarrybrod. His watch still registered Eastern European time, which is 1 hour ahead of Central European time. It was 12:15 when Ratchet was stabbed, not 1:15.
No, this is not possible. This explanation simply does not hold water. It is deficient in at least 12 points. You know very well that it is not the way in which the crime was committed, Monsieur Poirot.
Very well, Doctor. I see that I shall have to give you my second solution. But do not abandon the first one too abruptly. You may come round to it later. So we come to my second solution. First of all, I was struck by a remark made by Monsieur Bouc in the restaurant car on the first day after leaving Istanbul.
You mean about the company being so varied with so many different characters and nationalities?
Precisely. When I was reflecting on the murder, I tried to imagine whether such an assembly was ever likely to be collected together under any other conditions. And the answer which came to me was, only in America. In America, there might be a household composed of just such varied nationalities. An Italian chauffeur, an English governess, a Swedish nurse, a French lady's maid, and so on. That led to my little game of guessing. Casting each person for a certain part in the Armstrong family drama as a producer casts a play.
All your so-called guesses turned out to be quite remarkably accurate.
It is very good of you to say so. I then considered some of the evidence that had been presented to us. Let us take Mr. Masterman. You said that your master was in the habit of taking a sleeping draught when travelling by train.
That is correct. He invariably found it hard to get to sleep on a moving train.
But would Ratchet have taken one last night? A man who keeps an automatic under his pillow because his life has been threatened would scarcely take a sleeping draught. Whatever narcotic was administered to him must have been done without his knowledge. By whom? Obviously by McQueen or Masterman. Now, to pass to the evidence of Mrs. Hubbard.
I was wondering how long it would be before you got around to me.
Mrs. Hubbard has told us that lying in bed, she was unable to see whether the communicating door was bolted or not, and so asked Miss Olson to look for her. Now, though her statement may have been perfectly true if she had been occupying any of the even-numbered compartments, in the uneven numbers, such as compartment number 3, the bolt is well above the handle and could not therefore be masked by the sponge bag. I was forced to conclude that Mrs. Hubbard was inventing an incident that had never occurred. And now let me say a word or two about time. I felt certain that the evidence of Ratchet's watch had been deliberately faked. The crime was not committed at 1:15.
So, when did the murder take place?
In my opinion, Ratchet was killed at some time very close upon 2:00, the latest hour that Dr. Constantine gives as possible. Which brings us to the question of who killed him. I was struck by the extraordinary difficulty of proving a case against any one person on the train, and the curious coincidence that in every instance each alibi was confirmed by what I might describe as an unlikely person. McQueen and Colonel Arbuthnot, Miss Debenham and Miss Olson, Mr. Masterman and Signor Foscarelli, all were apparent strangers to one another. I said to myself, this is extraordinary. They cannot all be in it. And then I saw the light. They were all in it.
All of them?
I remember the remark of Colonel Arbuthnot about trial by jury. A jury is composed of 12 people. There were 12 passengers. Ratchet was stabbed 12 times.
So each blow was inflicted by a different person. Of course.
Ratchet had escaped justice in America. There was no question as to his guilt. I visualized a self-appointed jury of 12 people who condemned Ratchet to death and who were forced by the exigencies of the case to be their own executioners. It was all calculated perfectly, each person playing his or her allotted part. If I had not found that scrap of burnt letter, there would have been no clue pointed to the Armstrong case and no reason for suspecting any of the passengers on the train. It would be put down as an outside job.
And then the train ran into a snowdrift.
I can only imagine that the conspirators had a hasty discussion and decided to risk everything and go ahead, even with a celebrated detective in the next compartment to Ratchet.
But how could they have known who you were?
What other explanation could there be for the cry I heard in the night, or for the voice from Ratchet's compartment speaking in French? They were staged especially for my benefit. Why else go to so much trouble to plan clues that were deliberately intended to confuse? The pipe cleaner implicated Colonel Arbuthnot, who appeared to have a cast iron alibi and no connection with the Armstrong family, and the handkerchief of the Princess Dragomirov, who was too weak to have committed the crime. And there was one other very curious red herring.
The mysterious woman in the scarlet kimono.
She was certainly invented specifically to deceive me. And the wool was, briefly, pulled over my eyes. Now there is a further point to consider. For the conspiracy to work, the wagon lit conductor had to play a part in it.
But how could Michel possibly be involved in this?
He was a vital part of the plot, Monsieur Bouc. But that gave me 13 persons instead of 12. So, out of the 13, there must have been one of the 12 who did not strike Ratchet.
Remember, Monsieur Poirot, I gave you my word of honor that my wife did not leave the compartment.
And you are a man of honor, are you not, Monsieur le Comte? It was you who struck the blow, was it not?
But you still haven't explained where Pierre Michel fits into all this.
At first I could not understand. Then I remembered that the nursery maid who killed herself was French.
Suzanne was utterly innocent. The police tried to hold her responsible for what had happened.
Yes, Monsieur Michel. Your daughter had no part in the kidnapping. And you, Mr. Hardman, who tried so hard to convince us that you had been hired by Ratchet, you loved her, did you not?
She meant everything in the world to me, Mr. Poirot.
I cannot keep up with it all. Where does Fräulein Schmidt figure in all this?
I laid a little trap for her. I said I knew she was a good cook.
And I replied, all my ladies have said so. How stupid. I was deceived by your charm, Monsieur Poirot.
You were travelling as a lady's maid, Fräulein.
I was cook to the Armstrongs for 3 years.
Which leaves us with Mrs. Hubbard. Now, Mrs. Hubbard, let me say, played the most important part in the drama. By occupying the compartment communicating with Ratchet, she was more open to suspicion than anyone else. To act out the part she played, an artist was needed. And there was a great artist connected with the Armstrong family. Sonia Armstrong's mother, the famous actress, Linda Arden.
I always fancied myself in comedy parts.
And you played the part wonderfully, madame.
Even you, Monsieur Poirot, can't really imagine what it was like. One terrible disaster after another. My grandchild, my daughter, my son-in-law, the poor French girl. I was crazy with grief. We all were.
It would have melted a heart of stone. Armstrong was my best friend. He saved my life during the war.
After Ratchet escaped the course of justice, we decided that the death sentence had to be carried out.
At that stage, there were only 11 of us. Suzanne's father was in France, of course.
But the moment they approached me, there was no question of my not taking part.
At first, Monsieur Poirot, we thought we should draw lots as to who should be the executioner.
But I said, no, let us all carry out the sentence.
So we set to work to plan exactly how we could carry it through.
But how do you fit into all this, Mr. McQueen?
That's not so easy to answer. I suppose you could say I was in love with Sonia. Not that she knew anything about it, of course. I worshipped the ground she walked on. Oh,
I took pity on the poor boy. I told him to come around as often as he wanted. There didn't seem any harm in it.
There wasn't. It was just enough to be in her company every now and then. And after she died...
After my daughter died, Mr. McQueen did something that would have been impossible for the rest of us.
I never let Ratchet out of my sight. I followed him all the way across Europe and the Middle East. And when he fired his secretary, I just happened to be in the same hotel.
Monsieur McQueen let us know that Ratchet would be returning by the Orient Express. It was not difficult to get myself on that train, and the chance seemed too good to miss.
We were carrying out the sentence the law had failed to deliver. I wasn't too keen on the idea of stabbing the man to death, but a dagger was the kind of weapon that anyone could use, strong or weak. And it made no noise.
And each of you, in turn, entered Ratchet's darkened compartment through that of Mrs. Hubbard and struck your blow, so that none of you would ever know which wound had actually killed him.
Just so. Rather like a firing squad.
Well, you know everything now, Monsieur Poirot. What are you going to do about it? If it all really has to come out, can't you lay the blame on me and me only? I would have stabbed that man 12 times over very willingly. It's unnecessary to bring all the others into it. all these good, faithful souls, and poor Michel, and Mary, and Colonel Arbuthnot. They love each other.
Monsieur Bouc, you are a director of the Van Rooney Company. You have heard all the evidence. Was it the work of a lone assassin, or was it an act of justice carried out by 12 people in this carriage?
Well, in my opinion, Monsieur Poirot, the first theory that you put forward was the correct one. The killer left the train at Vinkovci. Oh. And I suggest that that is the solution we should put to the authorities when they arrive.
And what do you think, Dr. Constantine?
I agree with Monsieur Bouc.
So, having placed my solution before you, I have the honor to retire from the case.
I think this must mean that the line is clear.
And we have accomplished what we set out to do. Madame la Princesse, Monsieur le Comte, Madame la Comtesse, Mesdames et Messieurs, the Orient Express is about to depart.
In Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, John Moffat played Hercule Poirot and André Moran, Monsieur Bouc. Joss Ackland was Ratchet, Sylvia Sims, Mrs. Hubbard, Francesca Annis, Miss Debenham, Sean Phillips, the Princess Dragomirov. With Frank Windsor as Pierre Michel, Peter Polycarpou, Dr. Constantine, and Desmond Llewellyn, Masterman. The music was composed and performed by Michael Haslam. Murder on the Orient Express was dramatized by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.
I wanted to set down an account of the first time I worked with my esteemed friend, Hercule Poirot. And now I think the time has come at last to do it.
We present John Moffat as Hercule Poirot and Simon Williams as Captain Hastings in Agatha Christie's The Mysterious Affair at Stiles.
It was the summer of 1916. I had been invalided home from the front. And after spending weeks in a rather depressing convalescent hospital, I was given a month's sick leave. But having no near relations in England, I was rather at a loss what to do with myself.
Why don't you come and spend your sick leave with us? We'd love to have you.
And then, quite by chance, I ran across John Cavendish. I hadn't seen him for ages, and he insisted on taking me off to his club in Pall Mall.
It must be years since you last stayed at Stiles. The mater will be delighted to see you. I suppose you heard that she married again?
I certainly had not. Years ago, John's father had taken a second wife. He was a widower with two sons. Emily Cavendish was a handsome woman in her 40s, and she had immediately taken charge of everything. So much so that when John's father died, he had left Stiles Court to her for her lifetime, as well as the greater part of his fortune.
Mary and I are living there at the moment. Oh, you haven't met my wife, I think.
No, I haven't had the pleasure.
And Lawrence is there as well, of course. You remember my brother?
Yes. Wasn't he going to be a doctor or something of the sort?
Oh, yes, and he qualified all right, but his heart really wasn't in it. So now he just whiles away the time writing his verses, though he can never get anyone to publish them. Doesn't earn a penny, of course.
And your mother's new husband?
Alfred Inglethorpe is an ingratiating little weasel. Not to put too fine a point on it. and his being at Stiles is making life very difficult for all of us.
How did she come to meet him?
Through Evie. Well, she was after your time, I think.
Yes, yes, she must have been.
Evelyn Howard. She's the mater's companion and general factotum. Not exactly young and beautiful, but as game as they come. Well, this man Inglethorpe...
Your mother's new husband.
He turned up out of nowhere on the pretense of being a second cousin of Evie's, although she didn't seem to be particularly keen to acknowledge the relationship. The fellow's an absolute outsider. Well, you only have to look at him to see that. Uriah Heep in a bushy black beard.
Most unappetizing.
Well, the mater took him on as her secretary. You know, she's always running hundreds of societies, and of course it's got much worse with the war. And no doubt this fellow was quite useful to her. But you could have knocked us all down with a feather when, 3 months ago, she announced that the two of them were going to be married.
How old is this chap?
Oh, he's at least 20 years younger than the mater. Hmm. And he's beginning to have the most abominable influence over her. She can't make a decision without him. But you'll be able to see for yourself when you come down.
Life at Stiles Court did not sound exactly promising, but John had always been rather prone to look on the gloomy side of things. He met me at the absurd little station at Stiles St. Mary and drove us through the quiet Essex lanes. It seemed almost impossible to believe that, not all that far away, a great war was being fought.
I'm afraid you'll find it pretty quiet down here.
Oh, but my dear fellow, that's exactly what I want.
Oh, it's pleasant enough if you're content to lead the idle life. Have you got the time on you?
Just after 5.
Oh, too late to pick up Cynthia, then. She'll have left the hospital by now.
Cynthia? That's not your wife?
No, Cynthia's a protégé of the mater's, the daughter of a school friend of hers. She married a rascally solicitor who came a cropper. He killed himself, his wife died, and the poor girl was left an orphan and penniless. The mater came to the rescue, and she's been living with us ever since, nearly 2 years now. She works at the dispensary in the hospital in Tadminster.
We turned off through the lodge gates of Stiles Court and drove up the long drive. As we stopped in front of the house, a lady in a sturdy tweed skirt straightened up from the flower bed.
Back from the station already?
I've collected our wounded hero, Evie. This is my old friend Hastings.
Welcome to Stiles Court, Captain.
Thank you, Miss Howard. The garden's keeping you busy, I see.
Weeds grow like a house on fire. You'd better watch your step or I'll get you working on them too.
I'm sure I'll be only too delighted to make myself useful.
Don't say it. Soon wish you hadn't.
Where's tea, inside or out?
Out. Too fine a day to be cooped up in the house.
Come on then, Evie, and be refreshed. The labourer is worthy of his hire, you know.
Tea was spread out under the shade of a great sycamore. Lawrence was stretched on the grass, reading.
You remember my brother, of course.
Very well. Good to see you, Lawrence.
And you. All things considered, you're looking remarkably well.
And this is my wife, Mary.
How do you do, Captain Hastings? Sit yourself down. That chair's probably the most comfortable.
I shall never forget my first sight of Mary Cavendish. The vivid sense of slumbering fire that seemed to find expression only in those wonderful, tawny eyes of hers.
You must be glad to be out of your convalescent home at last. Dreadfully depressing places, I've always thought.
Oh, I don't know. One learns to make the best of things, and a sense of humour helps a good deal.
Then you will write to the princess, won't you, Alfred? She should be at Windsor, I think.
Here comes the mater.
There's no mistaking that poor sister. As long as I've known her, she's been trying to persuade someone to open something or other.
I'll drop a line to Lady Tadminster for the second bed. Or should we wait until we hear from the princess?
My dear, do you think it might be better to delay writing to her ladyship? If the princess declines, she would be a perfectly suitable person to open the fate.
And that's Inglethorpe. You see what I mean about that preposterous beard?
How right you always are, Alfred. Ah, but here is Captain Hastings. How delightful to see you at Stiles again after all these years. Alfred, darling, this is Captain Hastings.
A pleasure to make your acquaintance. Is soldiering your regular profession, Captain?
No, before the war I was at Lloyd's.
And you will return there when the war is over?
Perhaps. I might well make a fresh start altogether.
And what would you choose if you could do exactly as you wished?
Well, that depends.
What would you really like to do, Captain Hastings?
Well, to tell the truth, I've always had a secret hankering to be a detective.
Be better than Lloyd's, at any rate.
But what kind, Captain? A chief inspector?
or a Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, Sherlock Holmes every time.
And have you had any experience of detective work?
Well, I can't say I have, but I came across a chap in Belgium before the war, a very fine detective, and he said it all depended on method.
Don't mind a good detective story now and then. But it's all a load of rubbish, really. Keep you waiting to the last chapter for the criminal to be unmasked. In real life, you'd know at once.
You mean that if you were involved in a crime, Evie, you'd know the murderer straight away?
Of course I would. I'd feel it in my fingertips the moment he came near me.
It might be a she.
Might be, but murder's more a man's business.
Not in a case of poisoning. Isn't that supposed to be the woman's weapon? Dr. Bauerstein, who knows all about these things, says there are probably dozens of murders that go unsuspected because the medical profession knows next to nothing about uncommon poisons.
Oh, what a very gruesome conversation. I feel as if a goose were walking over my grave. Ah, but here's Cynthia. You're very late today, my dear.
I'm sorry. There was a last-minute rush at the dispensary.
Cynthia Murdoch looked delightfully fresh in her VAD uniform. She sat down on the grass by my chair, and I handed her the plate of sandwiches.
Why don't you come and sit here beside me? It's so much nicer.
What a very good idea. You work in the dispensary at Tadminster, I gather, Miss Murdoch.
For my sins.
And how many people have you poisoned?
Oh, simply hundreds.
When you've finished your tea, Cynthia, could you come and write a few notes for me?
Of course, Aunt Emily. I'll come straight away.
And perhaps we might have a little chat, Captain Hastings, before dinner. I'd love to hear your views about the war. I shall be in my boudoir.
Of course, Mrs. Inglethorpe. I'll be delighted.
My bedroom was in the left wing and looked over the park. From my window, I saw John walking slowly across the grass, arm in arm with Cynthia Murdoch. She looked so full of life and vigour, in contrast to John, who seemed gloomy and worn out.
Cynthia? Cynthia, where are you?
The girl rushed off back into the house. From the shadow of the trees, I noticed Lawrence looking after her, very melancholy and every inch the wistful poet. It was time for me to go down and talk to Mrs. Inglethorpe.
Such a comfort to have a real soldier in the house at last. I could hang my head in shame at the way those stepsons of mine carry on, as if the war had nothing to do with them.
Oh, but surely...
Oh, I know, I know. Lawrence is slightly lame, and John is technically too old for service. But as you well know, Captain Hastings, there are older men than John at the front, and boys more disabled than Lawrence. John goes out drilling with the Territorials once a week, but what good does that do?
And Lawrence?
He writes those miserable little poems of his, oozing with self-pity. Well, why can't he write something stirring and patriotic? Sons of mine, I hear you thrilling to the trumpet call of war.
Oh.
Well, at least Mary works with the land volunteers, gets up every morning before five and works till lunchtime. And there's darling Alfred, simply straining at the leash to be out there at the front, but I can't spare him. I really can't.
You need him for your bazaars and charities.
I simply do not know what I would do without that man. And he's put this house on a real war footing. Nothing is wasted at Stiles, not a scrap of food, not a single piece of paper. And we've given up late dinner, of course, as has Lady Tadminster, our member's wife. You'll have to be content with a rather spartan supper this evening, Captain Hastings.
But for all her talk of economy,